Welcome, I'm Steve Wiggins, and this is the fifth podcast of the Sects and Violence in the Ancient World blog. I would like to begin this podcast with a passage from the popular book Death, A Life by George Pendle, which was published in 2008. The book presents itself as a memoir of death as a fictitious or mythological character, and as he's narrating his life story, he comments in various ways on the religions that he encounters in the ancient world. The passage goes like this. As the number of civilizations grew, so did the number of gods, and scuffles began to break out in the desert between rival bands of believers. For the most part, the gods themselves didn't have anything to prove. It was their followers who were the problem. I remember one time a god named Yahweh, one of the many minor manifestations of God who had been left to look after things in his absence, was dragged out into the desert by his followers to battle the god Baal. The problem was that the two gods were on friendly terms. "Hello, Baal," rumbled Yahweh. "How's tricks?" "Not bad, thanks, Yahweh," roared Baal. "Same old, same old. Yam sends his best."
"Still god of the sea, is he?"
"Yes, he's sharing it with Poseidon. Yam's doing waves at the moment, while Poseidon's busy with the creatures of the deep. I believe there was some argument about who controlled longshore drift, but I think that's settled now."
"I'm glad to hear it," rumbled Yahweh. "Look, I am sorry about all this, Baal, but my boys are so damned devout."
"Oh, I understand," roared Baal. "You let them build a couple of temples to you, and suddenly they think they own you." While the gods chatted, their worshippers were brokering rules for a contest between the two supreme beings. Baal's priests had pushed for a pentathlon, but this was swiftly ruled out by Yahweh, who was nursing an old harvest festival injury. After a while, the prophet Elijah, who was leading the supporters of Yahweh, approached his god. "If you are the greatest god, the one true god," said Elijah, "then you must crush the false god Baal into the dust."
"But he's my friend," rumbled Yahweh. "Besides, if I'm the one true god, what's he doing standing right there?"
Baal gave a friendly wave at Elijah.
"This isn't funny, you know," snapped Elijah. "Would you prefer that we didn't believe in you?"
"Oh, stop being such a stick in the mud," Yahweh rumbled, and turned back to Baal to resume his conversation. "You know, Baal, wouldn't it be fine if we could somehow get rid of worshippers?"
"Well," roared Baal, "I hear it said that soon they'll have belief machines that pray much faster than humans, and with more feeling, too. Plus, they'll be much smaller, so that you can just carry them around in your pocket. Hey! You're disappearing."
Yahweh had indeed started to shrink.
"Stop that," rumbled Yahweh, spinning around to Elijah, who stood there smiling smugly.
"I've told them not to have faith in you until you crush Baal in your mighty hand, O Great One."
"But you're talking to him," cried Baal, desperately trying to stretch Yahweh back to his full size.
"That doesn't mean that I have to believe in him," said Elijah.
I must admit I felt quite sorry for the gods, regardless of which mythology they came from. To begin with, they had wowed humans with tricks and miracles and sopped up the spiritual adoration. Slowly but surely, however, the believers came to realize that the real power resided with them. As I've mentioned before, gods theoretically can't die, but they need to be believed in, otherwise they just blink out of existence. Wary of this, many of the more cunning gods had a devout hermit or two tucked away in desert caves, just in case their entire belief system suddenly went apostate. So it was that Yahweh and Baal were soon bullied into facing off against each other. It wasn't pretty. The air rang with obscenities and incense from both sets of supporters as they threw rocks at one another and then hid behind the hems of their gods' garments. Taking a deep breath, Baal turned to Yahweh's believers and roared, "I am Baal, son of Dagon and Ashtoreth, bull-horned god of gods, destroyer of moat. Feel my wrath, unbelievers." He bared his teeth and flames shot from his eyes. He winked at Yahweh, who gave him a surreptitious thumbs up.
"Well, set fire to these logs, then," cried out Elijah. On one side of the battleground lay a pile of logs in a pool of water. Baal looked upset.
"But they've been soaked in water," he roared.
"He's right, you know, Elijah," rumbled Yahweh. "They're completely drenched."
"That's the point," said Elijah sharply.
"Oh, very well," roared Baal, and, sitting his giant form down, picked up two sticks and began to rub them together. His followers began to look at one another.
"Not like that," yelled Elijah. "Use your so-called divine powers, false god."
Baal looked at Elijah as if he could just devour him then and there.
I did mention the logs were wet, didn't I? He roared before stepping toward the woodpile and staring at it very hard. There was a divine grunt, and a tiny wisp of steam wafted up from the top of the logs. Oh, well done, rumbled Yahweh. That was good, wasn't it? No, it wasn't, said Elijah. That was probably just evaporation caused by the sun. Oh, give him a break, rumbled Yahweh, as Baal sat down on the ground with his head in his hands. What do you want from us? Look, said Elijah, all we need to know is which of you is the greater God. Yahweh and Baal looked at each other. You could see what they were thinking. Bloody humans, never content with what they have. I had always found that the saying that all gods were jealous was not true. Many gods rarely minded who their followers worshipped as long as there was enough belief to go around. Nevertheless, there was a certain divine code that had to be followed in situations such as this. Sighing, the two gods rumbled and roared in unison, I am. A murmur broke through the crowd, and I could see the gods beginning to flicker a little as belief in them wavered. Oh, this is ridiculous, roared Baal. Why do you have to choose between one of us? Why can't you see that we're both special in our own different ways? Why can't you appreciate us for what we are rather than what you want us to be? Why can't we just rule over our people as before? Those who like horns can worship me, and those who like beards can worship him. Why not? I'm sorry, said Elijah. That's not going to cut it anymore. But there's enough room for both of us in the heavens, rumbled Yahweh. No can do, said Elijah. We're cutting our costs and downsizing to monotheism. Everyone's doing it. All those sacrifices add up, you know. Again, that is a passage from the book Death, A Life by George Pendle, specifically pages 101 to 104. The passage is a good starting point for thinking about the way that gods were perceived in the ancient world. We have the so-called Canaanite gods, a whole set of deities who were worshipped by the people of Ugarit and other places in the ancient world that surrounded them, including the people who lived in what would later become Israel. These gods were manifestations of various phenomena, either natural phenomena such as weather or plants or animals, or even abstract ideas could be thought of in terms of being gods. The idea of polytheism is a very common one, and indeed it seems to be what you might think of as the default form of religion. It seems more obvious, if you are thinking about constructing a religion, to recognize that different powers control different parts of nature. It doesn't stand to reason that all of nature is controlled by one single force, and so in the ancient world it was very common for people to believe in lots of different gods. The region of the Levant, which stretches from Turkey down along the coast of the Mediterranean to what used to be the historic nation of Israel and Philistia, was home to a variety of different religions. There were a number of small city-states that inhabited this region, and each of them had their own chief deity. The head god of the pantheon for the people of the Levant, for the most part, seems to have been a character called El. E-L. Some people call him El. El was conceived of as the head of the gods. He was the creator for some of these cultures, and he was considered to be the old man of the pantheon, maybe one of the original generation of gods. Unfortunately, we don't have much in the way of documentation of where El came from. He's one of those gods who was just simply there all the time. Nobody ever questioned that he was. He's simply part of the world as people knew it. If you stop to think about gods as being self-evident in a world where people didn't know how to explain things scientifically, then it's not so hard to understand that El was simply the stopgap, if you will, divine character. His very name means God. It is simply the word God. And so he is considered to be the ancient leader of the pantheon. I hesitate to use the word pantheon, by the way, because I think that really implies an awful lot concerning ancient Greek religion, which is quite different and distinct from the religion of the Levant, although it does borrow from it. For a convenient term, however, to discuss the group of gods, pantheon is sometimes the only choice we really have. In any case, El is in control of the gods. Now, beneath El and Asherah, his spouse, or his consort, I should say, there are another generation of deities. These are younger gods, and they have control of various phenomena. In the Ugaritic mythology, these gods are actually involved in combat for control over the known universe. As the narrative starts out in what we have left in the Ugaritic tablets, Yam, the god of the sea, is the chief deity, and that fits in well with ancient perceptions of the world, where chaos reigns before anything is set in motion or in order to stop chaos from being what it is. Chaos is the default state of things, and the sea was chaotic. You could not build on the water. It was constantly lashing into the shore. It was untamable, uncontrollable, and dangerous. So Yam was in charge, and eventually Baal, and we're not sure exactly where Baal comes from. His proper name is Hadad. His title Baal simply means Lord, but again, it's the more familiar title, so we'll simply use it. Baal comes along and challenges Yam for superiority of the gods, and they fight. The outcome seems to be that Baal vanquishes Yam, does not destroy him completely, but does indeed subdue him. So Baal becomes king of the gods. Later on in the narrative, the god Mot, whose name means death, comes to challenge Baal and indeed subdues Baal. Baal becomes a god who is killed or who dies. Baal eventually comes back to life and reigns over the gods once again, in a kind of uneasy sort of situation where we've got this concept of gods struggling for supremacy on the level of the deities below Ael. And he comes to be pretty much the patron deity of the city of Ugarit, as well as probably various other cities throughout the Levant who may have recognized him as Baal, Hadad, or under various other names. So that was the situation into which Israel came to be. These various other deities were recognized, they were seen, and there were lots of deities, many more than I've mentioned just now. In the Bible, we find that there is a very real concern about Baal. We might even say it was a disproportionate concern or fear of Baal, a kind of Baal phobia. And it doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of sense, other than what we may be dealing with here is the possibility that there were deities on this second tier of gods who were considered to be potential threats to the God of Israel, not in that they believed he was more powerful than Yahweh, but simply that he had the power to draw worshippers away from him, such as we heard in the episode in the quote from earlier in the podcast here. So the Israelites, when they show up historically, we're not really sure who they are or where they come from historically, but when they do show up on the scene, we find that they have already associated themselves with the god Yahweh. He is their deity. When they show up in the area of the Levant, in what is sometimes called Canaan, we know that they did not have a problem with the main deity, Ael. As a matter of fact, Yahweh and Ael were considered to be okay with each other, and even perhaps the same god. Now that's pretty striking when you stop to think about this early experiment with monotheism, because now we have the idea that these two gods, known by separate peoples over separate times and places, are actually the same character, one called Yahweh, the other called Ael. And we can see this clearly in the Hebrew Bible, where the name for God, Ael, is used. It's used rather freely and has no repercussions when it's used of Yahweh. Yahweh is called Ael. Ael can be called Yahweh. But with Baal, it's quite a different story. When Baal shows up on the scene, he is considered to be a threat, a rival. And the Hebrew Bible is quite clear that Baal worship must be eradicated in Israel. And so Baal is set apart as the evil deity, so much so that names that involved Baal, people often named their children with the name or title of a god embedded in their names, were considered to be wrong. Even the use of the word Baal, which had another meaning, basically husband in a marriage relationship, I know it's somewhat sexist, but it's simply the way it was in the ancient world. The man was the master or the lord, if you will, in the relationship. even some of the prophets, such as Hosea, say that there's coming a day when we'll no longer be able to use that word even, because it sounds like the God's name, and we have to get rid of that in Israel. It seems that Baal's fatal error was that he simply was a victim of the sources that challenged monotheism. Monotheism was a new idea. It was one that was gaining speed and force in Israel as time went on. And by the period of the exile, it had become normative Israelite thought. And Baal stood to challenge that basic concept that there was one God. And even though the Israelites could allow for a connection between Baal and Yahweh, indeed, even a coalescence between the two, they simply had no way to fit Baal into this equation. It's not that Baal was evil per se, but he simply represented something that the Israelites did not want to be associated with. Baal, also in the Ugaritic mythology and also in other places in the ancient world, was associated with the thunderstorm. So, quite clearly, one of his areas of influence is in the rain. The stories of Elijah in the Hebrew Bible focus very strongly on the drought that is caused by Elijah's prediction that the rain will stop. In other words, it is a slap in Baal's face for the God who controls the rain to be put out of business by Yahweh. Elijah is presented as a real antagonist to Baal as well, and it seems to be, again, an indication that the area of fertility, in the larger sense of the word, not in the sense of fertility gods, which simply did not exist in the ancient world, but fertility in the larger sense, the fertility of the land, was something that Yahweh had to have control over in order for this monotheistic experiment to work. You could not leave the growing of crops, the survival of life itself, to chance or to any other god. It had to be Yahweh's area of influence, and it was Baal's area of influence before that. So between Yahweh and Baal, the Israelites had decided for Yahweh, and Baal had to be put into the background and subjugated. It's unlikely that Baal's fate is the same as is narrated in the book Death, a Life. If you take a look at the rest of the chapter, you'll see what becomes of Baal, where what his fate is according to the author. It's humorous, but not accurate. We do know that Baal did eventually diminish to the point that he simply disappears from the historical record. And later on, when the Israelites come into contact with the idea of a supreme anti-god, if you will, probably through their interaction with Zoroastrian religion during the Persian period, they come to see an anti-god who is given names that are similar to Baal, and like Baal, portrayed with horns, only at this point in time he comes to be known by quite a different name and a different mythological character, and that is, he seems to become in time what the later Israelites and the early Christians came to know as the devil, through no fault of his own.